Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome once again. This is another one of our Yes Magazine conversations. In this issue of Yes Magazine, their 15th anniversary issue, they profiled what they call 15 extraordinary people transforming the way we live. And we're about to talk with Deepak Bhargava, who is the head executive director of the Center for Community Change and a grassroots activist, as they say in here, inside the Beltway, but he's also outside the Beltway a great deal as well. And Deepak, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be with you.
Now, we participated in Take Back the Dream, a conference that you helped create. But my guess is that a lot of people listening to this from Yes and from our radio program may never have heard of the Center for Community Change. So let's begin there and what that has to do with you being a voice of the grassroots inside the Beltway.
Sure. Well, CCC was created in 1968 by leaders from the Civil Rights Movement and the War on Poverty and the Union Movement to be a living memorial to Robert Kennedy after his death, to be a support center to efforts to organize poor people and particularly people of color all around the country, to help grassroots groups get started, to help them do their organizing, and also to link them together to take on major campaigns on banking discrimination, on affordable housing, on jobs, on immigrant rights. And that's really what the organization has done over its 40-plus years of being in existence, is connect grassroots activism in the neighborhoods to the halls of power in Washington, D.C.
So, and your own kind of sojourn from your beginning, your roots, you were born in India and came as a young child to Brooklyn, is that right?
To the Bronx.
The Bronx,
you know,
I mean to say the Bronx.
Very particular about that difference.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. And I deeply apologize.
yes, my family emigrated when I was very young to the United States, and we settled in the Bronx. And I grew up in a multiracial, overwhelmingly of color community, African-American, Latino, working class, and low income. And, you know, that really helped to shape my view of the world and my sense of what needed to be done to make the rhetoric about the American dream and the promise of this country real for everybody in it.
So I'm very curious just in your thoughts on where we are at this moment, because a lot of the things I've seen that you've written and said in public, you gauge the situation by often saying things like, it can go this way or it can go that way.
Yep.
That we could either build a progressive movement and then we could have a small, as you say, Democratic edge in Congress, or we could see a onslaught of a Republican takeover of both houses. So I'm curious, and that is the way you look at it. I mean, this is, you see us living in a very volatile but critical historic moment, I have a feeling.
Yeah, we are, I think, at a pivotal moment in the country's history. There is a concerted, well-funded, strategic effort on the part of radical conservatives in this country to essentially undo the 20th century. Now, people often say, oh, you're just exaggerating when you say that. But if you think about this agenda, it's undoing civil rights and voting rights. It's undoing the New Deal and the Great Society and the great legacy of those periods, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, the safety net for the most vulnerable, for our elderly. It's about undoing the right of workers to organize and bargain collectively, to raise their wages. It's about kind of returning to, I guess, what Rick Perry called vulture capitalism, which we had at the turn of the 20th century. No rules, no regulations, all the wealth going to the top 1%. So this is really a very radical agenda, and the Tea Party is really has become the kind of shock troops for this effort. And the good news about 2011, from my point of view, is they really threw their best punch, and most, some things did get through, but most of what they wanted to do did not become law. But that makes this year, I think, absolutely pivotal. If a social justice movement in this country can mount a comeback and put an agenda of economic and social justice on the agenda, mobilize for the elections, there's no reason why we can't turn this dynamic around very, very quickly.
Well, Well, I'm curious when you say that. I mean, when you look at where we are in America today, and the I think great disappointment, whether it's the progressive community or many other communities in President Barack Obama, and the really vicious reaction to his presidency that is not just about his being a moderate liberal president as Carter and Clinton were, but because he's black.
Yes.
And I think we don't talk about that enough as well. Let's just start there. I mean, we don't talk enough about a lot of this diatribe. I guess you saw what the Speaker of the House in Kansas said recently.
Yes, I did.
You know,
yes,
that he wants the Obamas, her, Michelle Obama, to be a widow and the kids to be fatherless. I mean, and he's Speaker of the House of the state of Kansas.
Yeah, I think, as I say, the moment is pivotal, and it's actually a very dangerous moment, exactly because what's happening is the country is changing. You know, we will soon be a majority of color nation, and the fact that we have our first African-American president speaks to that change, the profound changes that have happened in our society. There is a lot of fear in America about that change.
Yes, yes.
And it has unleashed a kind of viciousness and ugliness that I think really threatens some things that we all kind of take for granted. You know, we thought, oh, people fought, they sacrificed, they died 40, 50 years ago for things that we take for granted today, and we're not going back to that. Well, the agenda really is to take us far, far back into our country's past, and the venom you see against the president, I don't agree with the president about all the policies, but the kind of racialized venom you see is a product of that fear.
Right, and deeply rooted in, I think, the history of racism in America.
It is. It absolutely is.
And the fear of losing, even though it may be unconscious, maybe conscious on some level, some people, the kind of sense of privilege that white people have had in America for a long time, this is a very threatening moment.
This fear of this constituency of color that is coming to its own, finding political power, power in boardrooms, in communities, et cetera. And there's a sense of loss for many Americans in that transformation, not a sense of we've realized the promise or we're on our way to realizing the promise of this country with work to do, but a sense that the gain of some means a loss for others. Now, I think that's a fundamentally mistaken view, but in a time of economic catastrophe and crisis where people feel extremely insecure, those fears can be preyed upon and fanned and built up into something that is really very frightening.
So at the Center for Community Change and the work that you're doing, what do you see as the alternative vision that would actually get people excited in America, especially around jobs?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I think the key building block for turning this country around is a aggressive, big, bold plan and program to invest in this country and put people back to work. You know, we have a jobs gap now of something on the order of 20 to 25 million. And even with the slight decrease in the unemployment rate, it'll take 7 years to get back to where we were before the recession.
Right.
In communities of color, that unemployment rate, the real unemployment rate, is 20% or higher. And among young people of color, it's astronomical. So we have a dramatic crisis. And the truth is, we actually know what to do. It's not an enormous mystery. The first thing is we have to get out of this deficit-cutting mindset. In the long term, it is probably true that we need to bring order to the nation's finances, but in the short term, in the next few years, we need a massive program of investment in infrastructure, physical infrastructure, bridges, roads, tunnels, etc., and also in human capital, in education and caring for kids and the elderly. And if we do that, we will both help to address this critical unemployment crisis that's happening today and also lay the groundwork for future prosperity in the country, because those things make us more productive.
Now, Joseph Stiglitz, in a short but really intense piece he wrote for Vanity Fair, I guess in the last issue before this, posited that that Democrats and Republicans neither get what's really going on, that we have we're entering a different economic order and world with technology and with the in what we're facing, and that the same old paradigm, the same old ideas, as he would put it, that happened at FDR won't fit now. We have to do something sort of different, which, and he's clearly saying the same as you are in terms of doing something to build the infrastructure and rebuild America. But I wonder how you see that happening. I mean, let's start with that. How do you see that happening? And how does
Well, a key point there is we can't go back. No one wants to go back to a period where lots of people were left out and where we were polluting and destroying the environment. You know, it's going to have to be a new kind of foundation, a new kind of economy that has sustainability at its core, that has human well-being at its core. So it's not going to be going backwards. It's really going to be going forwards into a 21st century vision. What I think it will take is nothing less than a social justice movement that's really grounded in economic justice. And, you know, we've seen that happen. People talked about the protests in Wisconsin. They talked about everywhere the Occupy movement, which has really put this inequality issue back on the national radar screen. And in between that, I traveled the country, and I saw it was deeply inspiring and moving. People in Ohio fight back against the assault on unions, and people in Montana fighting back against horrible budget cuts, and people in North Carolina fighting for state-level jobs programs and assistance to the unemployed. So the seeds of a movement of working class and low-income people of the 99% are there. Washington will not change itself. The dynamics of money and kind of a corrupted process are very, very entrenched. So it's going to take that kind of movement from the outside. As we saw during the 1930s, FDR, you know, did a lot of great things, but he did it under huge pressure from unemployed workers, from unions, from others. The civil rights movement helped to bring the transformation in the 60s. So it's that same kind of movement building that's required today. And I see the consciousness developing, the anger developing, the sense of possibility developing for a different course everywhere. And that's what really gives me hope that we can get there.
Now, I want to talk about how we get there and what does that mean. I mean, there are two things that will be looming in this next year. Let's take one first, the presidential election. Mm-hmm. There are many people in the progressive movement who say, abandon Obama and build a third party. Others who would say we should forget the presidential election altogether and concentrate on local movement building and do something and take it from there. I mean, how do you see that playing out? Because that is going to play out in this next 8 months, 10 months, yeah. 9 months.
Well, I think the view that we need to retreat from elections is a big, big mistake.
Uh-huh.
The conservative movement is very clear. You know, the reason they're so determined to pass these voter ID laws and voter suppression laws is because they understand that it actually matters.
And they are doing that, and they're moving very strongly on that in some key states.
I mean, the laws they've just passed already will have the effect of reducing the number of people who vote by 5 million people. And those people will be overwhelmingly African Americans, Latinos, young people, the elderly, all the poor, folks who are less likely to have that ID. My favorite example, by the way, is in Florida, where they reduced the period for early voting, and the first day they went after was Sunday, where there's a tradition in that state of African Americans coming out from church to go to the polls. You know, so they're doing this in all kinds of ways. So they're clear that voting matters, and the reason they're clear that it matters is because the only antidote to organized money that is corrupting our political system is organized people, and one of the expressions of that is voting. Now, it should not be an exclusive focus on the presidential race. So, you know, the conservative movement built over 30 years in this country by doing turnout and electing people to school boards, to city councils, to state legislatures, and this year has really shown us how important these state legislatures are, the amount of power that they potentially can exercise over mm-hmm. people's lives. So it's got to be up and down the ballot, and it can't just be mobilizing for candidates or for an election. It has to be mobilizing on an agenda for the 99%, jobs and economic justice being at the heart of that.
So And then how does that happen, though? That's the next part of the question. So, well, let me jump back and do something first. So when people argue or discuss with you third party or back Barack Obama, what's your response?
Well, CCC, happily, is a nonpartisan organization, so I can duck that question.
Okay, we'll duck it. So, so on the other side, then, how does that happen? I mean, when you look around the country,
yep,
and you see, like, here where we're talking today in Baltimore. I'm in Baltimore. You're in Washington. And in Baltimore, there's an Occupy movement that has grown to try to combine these young activists with mm-hmm. people, working people in communities, stopping foreclosures and stopping a youth jail from being built. And it's been very interesting to watch this movement grow here. My sense is that that's happening across the country.
Yes.
In some ways connected because they know each other exists, but really disconnected on another level.
Well, you know, it is happening all over the country, and it is very practical, hard day-to-day work to do. And I'll just give you an example. In Arizona in 2010, that state passed this horrendous, very racist, anti-immigrant
yes.
bill. So people organized in that community to protest, to do a boycott, et cetera, and they also organized at a very grassroots level to have thousands and thousands of young people engaged. And this year, the author of that law became the first sitting state Senate president ever to be recalled in the nation's history. It sent a shockwave through that state, and every anti-immigrant bill this year was defeated. How did that happen? It didn't come because anybody in power wanted to kind of take this on. It happened because people went door-to-door in that district and in that state mm-hmm. to engage people in a conversation, build an organization, and then come out swinging. And that's the kind of brass tacks politics, small p politics, that we have to engage in. Get clear on an agenda, recruit people, including people who may not already be engaged. It can't just be the existing activists.
Right.
And then go forward.
And do you see that happening? I mean, do you see that happening?
I do. I've been around the country now for this last year and had a chance to be in church basements and union halls and in the streets and almost every part of the country. And the turnout, it doesn't get reported by the national media the way that it should, but the turnout and energy and activism is astonishing. You know, there was a period when, 2010, when people were just discouraged. They felt like we elected this guy president and everything hasn't changed overnight, and what's the point of getting engaged and voting? And I think that showed in the results of the 2010 elections. In 2011, the threat was real. Massive, vicious budget cuts, voter ID laws, anti-union laws, anti-immigrant laws. I mean, the agenda kind of was unmasked, and people saw what the stakes were. And so all over the country, you saw this huge pushback with rallies and petitions and referendums and the like on a scale we haven't seen in quite some time. So I think the energy is coming back. Here's the key thing. That energy can't be an adjunct to any politician or party. It can't. It's got to be based around an agenda that is owned by people who develop it themselves. Because when we get in the mindset of, well, we elected so-and-so, and we kind of wash our hands of it and say it's their job to take it forward, that's when we start to lose ground.
Now, how do your – and I know when you helped create the Take Back the Dream conference.
Yep. You were
one of the main conveners of that conference. And the unions were a big part of that conference.
They were.
So what you just described as – an approach to building something. How do you think the unions fit into that? We'll be talking to Leo Girard again this Wednesday. And we'll put that to him when we talk to him about the unions and the Democratic Party and what the future should look like and what the unions
yep.
should be doing.
Well, the unions have a crucial role to play in rebuilding a progressive movement in this country. You know, that in this country, it is almost impossible to imagine how we have greater economic justice, more rights for people who are left out without a vibrant union movement. And the reason is that they have mass membership of working class people, and if they are large enough, they have the financial resources and the political clout to make things happen. And so it's not a coincidence that the leading edge of the spear of these right-wing attacks, not just in this last year, but really over the last 30 years, has been to try to cripple the union movement, because they understand correctly that that is the center of power, the base of power for an alternative vision of what this country could and should be. Now, in this moment, the union movement is called to reinvent itself because the old rules no longer apply. I mean, it's almost impossible to the way that labor law works in the country. Even if a majority of workers, when you go to a worksite, want to join the union, the way the rules operate, they're so stacked that it's impossible to do so. So unions will not grow again unless we see this kind of broad-based movement for economic justice that I'm talking about, which means other sectors have to be partners in the struggle, from faith community, from communities of color, et cetera, have to be a big piece of it. And the union movement has to invest in reaching out to workers who are not part of unions, because it's a small share now of the overall workforce. There are lots of people who are unemployed, underemployed, employed, but don't make a decent living, who want a vehicle. And one of the encouraging things about this last year to me has been a lot of these struggles that I described around the country, in the Ohios and North Carolinas of the world, unions and community groups who work through churches or neighborhood associations or tenant associations really came together to find some common cause. And I think the seeds of the possibility of a union community alliance are really there.
So where do you see the juncture of the kind of organizing you're talking about, which is door-to-door, which is the kind of work, the only way you get it done, and the direct activism, direct action of activists around the Occupy movement? How do you see those two coming together or not?
That's a great question. The honest answer is I'm not sure. I think they need to. I think they need to. And in some places, you're beginning to see that happen. You were speaking to in Baltimore how around foreclosures, working class folks and occupiers are working together. I'm also seeing that in California with occupations of homes and trying to stop this foreclosure crisis that is ripping through the country. So around those kinds of practical projects, I think there's a lot of room for collaboration. Here in D.C., we helped to put together some events in December called Take Back the Capitol, which was a joint enterprise of occupiers, unions, and community groups. And so the crowds you saw blocking traffic on K Street, for example, were unbelievably diverse. Working class white union members, young occupiers, Latino and African American, low-income working class folks from community organizations. Now, that to me was a picture of what's possible. It doesn't mean that it's easy. There are cultural and other differences that are very, very profound. But what was interesting to me in that gathering was you saw people have these conversations. And even though they didn't necessarily talk the same way about it or look at things the same way, the kind of clarity that we face a profound economic crisis and that inequality, corporate power are at the center of it, that runs through all those different groups. So I see the possibility. How to make it happen and stick is something we're definitely still working on.
So, as you look at this, finally, do you see? I know you, in some sense you have to keep an optimistic face building a movement. Everybody does, but what does your intellect and your gut say about what is about to happen, and where you and the Center for Community Change will put their efforts?
Yeah. Well, one of the people who brought me into the Center for Community Change like to say that the test of our character is not how we show up when things are easy, but how we show up when things are hard.
Amen.
So, you know, right. In the 2008, 2009, it seemed like the country was finally coming out of a dark period and a very dark past. You know, it all looked up. It looked sunny and hopeful. It was easy to be an activist in that period. In 2010, with the Tea Party on the rise and, you know, the vicious setbacks here in Washington and so forth, it became pretty hard. In 2011, I've begun to see the wheel turn. Now, will it turn fast enough? Will it turn far enough in order to get us to deal with these profound challenges the country faces to address the level of suffering we see all around us? I don't know. But I feel like our task is to make that turning happen as quickly as possible. You know, one of my favorite quotes is Dr. King said, "The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice." I think that's true. And so these ups and downs that we experience, we kind of have to take a longer view, even as we do everything we can to make things move quickly towards justice.
We have been talking to Deepak Bhargava, who is executive director of the Center for Community Change, who in this last issue of Yes Magazine was named one of the 50 extraordinary people transforming the way we live. And Deepak, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be with you.